And now Iowa Contemporary Art presents Icon Art Radio.
This is Icon Art Radio with Alan Cobb, Donna Colby, and Bill Teeple. That's me. All right, Donna, go for it. We're talking about curating.
Curating, yeah. I started thinking about the various aspects of curating in a museum or a gallery because I recently read a little short column in the New Yorker about a new show that's currently at the Metropolitan Museum in New York City that is curated in a very unusual way. It's a show called The Age of Rembrandt, which includes painters, Dutch paintings from that whole era, various artists, including Rembrandt. And the timeline that they're using in hanging this show is according to when the museum acquired the painting. So when you're going through the show, it seems kind of random. But the person who wrote this article says, wall text extol the donors. The ploy suggests a cargo cult setting out lures for potential benefactors to just kind of give you the history of the various people who made these donations. But then he goes on and he talks about the other possible ways that a show could be curated other than the typical ones that people have used in the past. And I liked his sentence he has towards the end. He says, sportively arbitrary hanging of great art should happen more often.
Yes. Yeah, I remember that article. Sportively hanging great art.
So, being a curator, Bill, what do you think of this? What's your angle on curating, and what's your kind of preference or knowledge about different ways people have curated art?
Well, I'm actually not a curator. I am a curator because that's just, I've ended up being one. But I'm neither a trained curator nor a trained teacher. I'm an artist. and we've spent probably 40 shows trying to define what that is. But it has to do with expressing my love of reality. So when I hang a show, it has to do with the available works of art and how I intuitively respond to them and how I intuitively place them to try to awaken interest in them with others and to also get others to be as intrigued and interested as I am. And that's about the bottom line. Otherwise, it's totally intuitive. I have the patterns that you talk about, that the way shows have always been hung. I have those patterns in mind because I've gone to those kinds of exhibits time and time again. I've experienced oddball and alternative hangings and showings, everything going to what we might call happenings, mm-hmm. that are not exactly an art show at all, but an in-the-moment sort of like event. But also shows have been hung something that way by interesting, mostly bodies of artists more than curators, or curators on dope in the 60s.
Something like curators.
That. So what are some of the...
In other words, let me say what I mean by that. There was a school of art in San Francisco, which was happening at the time that everything else was happening in San Francisco in the late 60s. So things got a little more open and creative. And this a curator tried to come along and define and package this group, which I would call Neo-San Francisco Dada, to give it a name. San Francisco Neo-Dada. That was a better name than what Peter Seltz gave it, who was the curator that came to town and tried to package it.
Not to be confused with Nzarga Dada.
That's right.
So what was the name
he called
gave
it? Funk. He tried to call it the Funk Art School, but actually that didn't take. Hmm. But these guys, these people that fit into this category, they one of them found this funny looking step up stool thing in a thrift store, and thought it was great, and took it home, and then regarded it almost with the sort of like same degree of authority in their art world as the fountain of our mutt was in the New York art scene of the 1900s. That is Duchamp's urinal that he displayed. Mm-hmm. But this was known amongst that group as the slant step. Mm-hmm. And so they decided together to do a slant step show, and everyone made a slant step. And then they tried to curate this thing together, this group of artists, and they placed them here and there, as an art show should be placed. And in the end, they said no, and they threw them all in the corner, and and that was the show. So this is the type of creativity we can bring to curating, and I'm all for it. And in fact, Al and I have been discussing an installation that is more creative and open-ended. But ask some more questions about this, because I'm...
Well, I think it would be interesting to hear what some of the more common traditional ways of curating a show you have come across, or any of us have come across in various places.
Well, most people try to have some kind of unity of theme to a show. So it might be a photography show that all deals with feminine issues or gender issues, or with a particular style of photography, or a painting show where there's some kind of a unity that is tried to be achieved in terms of, and this is a spontaneous sort of thing that the curator as an artist, because a show is like creating a painting. Mm. And you've got these diverse elements, and you want to put them together with some kind of a unified sort of a thing that comes across. So a painting show, you would, maybe they'd all be of an abstract nature, as opposed to a puppy dog, you know, puppy dog portraits, and then some Jackson Pollock type abstraction over here. And so that's really getting like chaotic. So the idea of spontaneous curation, mm-hmm. I'd like to know more about what he means by that.
Well, I think he just means, you know, whimsical, outside the box, instead of...
Well, I think the slant step show would fit in that category.
Yeah. I mean, this guy was thinking more about shows that are still, you know, accessible. but you know, I was wondering as you were talking if there's any way of having a show that doesn't have a theme. I mean, really, the fact that it's in the gallery gives it a theme.
Yeah.
And maybe it's hard to perceive what the theme is, but certainly, you know, if you had paintings by artists whose last names all begin with J, you know, it would still, that would be the theme. And the patron, the visitor to the gallery, might figure it out eventually if they saw who painted all of them.
Well, that's odd. You know, they going back to the J. original show here, that's, mm-hmm. It's an unusual... I think that's interesting.
And yeah,
that
is a very interesting way of doing a show.
What we would call somewhat of a spontaneous or an outside-the-box thinking, because we're used to a period being presented in some kind of chronological order, and we want to see the paintings in like a chronological order. But in this case, there's chronology, but it puts emphasis on collecting.
Yeah, it's the chronology of what was hot at the time.
And now, why did they choose this one first, you know?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Why was the money that they had at hand go for this one?
Right.
Maybe it was the only one available, but maybe not.
Or maybe they had one patron that year who just happened to love that piece.
So it brings you into how a museum comes, like a permanent collection. Now,
they're dealing with the permanent
collection. Yeah. So they're drawing from the permanent collection, and the theme of this show is
how did it
come about.
Yeah,
228 and they were all 17th century Dutch paintings. So that's a theme overriding the whole thing. But and they started acquiring these in 1871. So there's the sequence begins at that point. And
I would venture to guess that when you curate a show, a significant bit of your attention is on what kind of an effect the show is going to have on this particular community. Is that fair to say?
I can't keep it out of the consideration. Yeah. There's this, because of connect, you know, we're putting up pieces on the wall and we want to connect with people with those pieces.
Yeah.
So there's always, with me, there's my own kind of personal taste. There's mm-hmm. my educated discrimination and knowledge mm-hmm. about art.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's how I can bring that out to this particular audience in this particular place in such a way that people will grow in their understanding and also be fulfilled by recognizing patterns that are meaningful to them.
So I have a question for you then. Suppose money was no issue. You had unlimited money and you could choose any space you wanted to give a show. What would be the ideal Bill Teeple curated show in the best of all possible worlds? Not thinking about any particular audience, but what would express your just visionary show?
If we have all potential artworks that are out there
mm-hmm.
and money is not an issue, I would...
Let's do a Rothko show.
Yeah, I mean, I would...
a late Rothko show.
I would gravitate to those highest moments in the history of art.
Yeah.
And I would either bring together the significant pieces of the entire of art history in one room.
Yeah.
Or I would select a single artist and then select the pieces I felt were the finest pieces to put together.
It's probably not a fair question to ask you on the spur of the moment because it's such a huge, wonderful dream that it probably deserves thinking about
would
for
be,
a while.
Well, it would just be fun to ramble on about that. But, you know, I would probably have a Mark Rothko show.
Mm.
Now, that set aside and forgetting all the high moments of art, I have debated even recently. Actually, before we got the new gallery, I had a very serious debate going on in my mind as to whether I should continue to run a contemporary art organization that would continue to do what we had been doing, which was showing regional artists and art that was educative and or to forget all that mm-hmm. and simply make it my studio and giving myself freedom to do anything I want in there, which is, I think, kind of what you're getting at here. What if I could do anything I wanted? Mm-hmm. What would that be? So this is very lively in my awareness, especially when Icon starts to run out of money. And by the way, everyone should know that Icon is completely publicly supported by the community here. And if we don't have money coming in to maintain the gallery that puts on these nice showings and all of Icon's programs, we will be seriously entertaining what I'm about to discuss.
Which sounds like a lot of fun to me.
Which is to simply... turn it into my private studio and have it no longer be a nonprofit, publicly supported studio where I am responsible to give something that I think that the people that are supporting me would like and deserve. But if it was my own private studio, then I would find that very fascinating. I feel like I need to do this thing which mm-hmm. has been discussed in the past under the name of the Garden Studio, but mm-hmm. and I think gardens would have to be involved, actually. But it's mainly that I sit in the middle of this thing not knowing anything at all about what's going to happen there. And then I wait for an impulse to come, and then I respond to it. This is what I do anyway as an artist.
Yeah.
But I have these other considerations I have to take into account. Now we're talking about no longer taking these considerations into account, but simply standing there in the void, waiting for something to happen. And being a creative person, my intention is always to have something happen that I'll drive into manifestation. And I see it as a combination of manifesting some works myself, teaching, actually verbally discussing how I feel about art and making of art, and curating. And it would be a three-pronged effort. I think that all three would help each other out. The talking and the teaching would reveal what I'm doing with the making, but the making would reveal a lot more about my deeper inner what's happening within me, and would be a spontaneous, like, calligraphic statement about moving through time. Then the curation would be my fascination with objects that come into my proximity. I have to take into account now the politics of art, which means is it appropriate to the place and the group? Our mission as the Iowa Contemporary Art, so I'll stay with working with Iowa artists and a certain pool of artists that I feel I need to deal with and I need to present. But this thing would be different. This would mean, this would mean that I don't have to give a reason. The fact that it's on the wall is its own reason. And I would feel the freedom that I don't feel now to say, put one tiny little thing on the wall of the entire 2,000 square feet space, and that's it. If that impulse that came was to do that, I would do that. And I would feel, and I would love to do this.
Yeah.
You're getting me very excited.
Yeah. Well, I'm picturing something exciting. Too, which I don't know. I don't know whether this is part of your vision or just my fantasy overlaid onto your vision, but I imagined how interesting it would be to have, as part of the, quote, show that people would be able to come in and participate in and see, would be to walk into this place and actually see Bill in the act of creating
creating. This is what I envisioned for upstairs when I almost pulled the plug on Icon. And it was because Icon needed a push and it needed to galvanize community support. And we were able to achieve that by moving down onto the square. So when we did that and everyone saw the potential, then I said yes to continuing Icon and keeping it going. But I was really seriously visualizing myself as a working studio and that actually people could come in. I mean, there would be times when I wouldn't let anybody in, but there'd be times when people could come in and...
That's what I imagine for the square for Fairfield. I would like to see on every side of the square at least one working studio that's open to the public part of the time, that's got a storefront so you can look in even if it's not open at that particular hour. And the artist or craftsman or artisan who is in there, or a group of people, are doing their thing in there. And that's the kind of thing that people will drive to Fairfield just to see it. And I mean, I was in Toronto last summer, and there's a section of town with this old factory complex, and they've got studios of all kinds that people have just, you know, they pay almost no rent. and they get to use the space. And they use the space creatively, partly to create things and partly just using the space as itself as a work of art, like a curator does. And they hang their works, or they attach their works, or they construct their works, or they display their works. And it's absolutely fascinating. It's just wonderful. And you get to see it changing from week to week, and there's always something new happening in each one of these places. And I just imagine, you know, when you were asking Bill what would he do if he had unlimited funding, you know, for the ultimate show, I can't imagine an ultimate show. But I can imagine, you know, just getting a handful of really creative and productive and fairly organized people into these places where they're accessible to the outside world. And part of the deal is, you know, yeah, you don't have to pay any rent and utilities, but you also have to be open to the public, you know, from 2 o'clock till 4 o'clock. 3 days a week and always on Saturday or something like that, whatever the rule is. And then they go in there and they do their thing, and you see them building the thing, and then you see them tear it down because it didn't come out the way they wanted, and then you see them build something else. And next door or across on the next side of the square, there's somebody blowing glass or, you know, firing ceramics or making a quilt or whatever. And it's just seeing the creativity and having the studio or be the gallery and the gallery be the studio is just wonderful.
It's much more true to the art process.
See? Yeah. Mm-hmm.
This thing of like stopping it here and taking those pieces and putting them into an artificial situation is not at all truthful to the art process.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And most artists feel like they're not getting across the whole picture.
Yeah. Plus, you get to see the artist's environment, you know, because the artist is picking things that will become part of some other work, either by inspiration or by actually being incorporated into it. And the things that they have around them, if they're working in that kind of an environment, they're going to display them, or, you know, they're going to be selective about what it is that accumulates in their environment. And it'll just have to be interesting if they're creative people.
I had an idea one time that I called the changing room, which was a nice space, one big room. And for each month, for 1 month, a group of artists, people would like give proposals. You know, a group of maybe five artists would give a proposal of what kind of thing that they would like to do in that room for 1 month. And then that group of artists would have that room for 1 month to do exactly what you were talking about, to create whatever they wanted to create. But one end of the room would be like a cafe, mm-hmm. where people could come in and sit and drink coffee and watch these artists work, or videotape them, or write about them, or write their own thing that was inspired by being in that atmosphere. And so in the end of that month, you would not only have whatever these artists had created, you would also have the things that the writers had written about it. You would have the little film that, you know, maybe a few films that various people had made of the artist from different angles while they were working. And then the next month, it would be just taken down, and another group of artists with maybe completely different orientation, possibly performance artists or musicians or whatever, would have that space and would.
Well, we need to have that in Fairfield.
Yeah,
there's a lot of things.
We should have
that
a few of those in addition to. I mean, we have one in a sense. That little tiny narrow alleyway that got turned into a building over by Dottie's. By the
Henderson.
Between Henderson's and the salon. Mm-hmm. And that's the only space on the square that's so useless and inexpensive that students keep, you know, taking it over and using it as their canvas for a week or a month or two, and then they move on and somebody else takes it over and does some interesting thing in it. And of course, you can't have two people in there walking in opposite directions without having to say excuse me and rub against the wall. But it's a, you know, it's almost usable for what you're talking about, and it would be great. I mean, we've got these empty buildings, empty storefronts, empty rooms upstairs.
The best things you see like this are students that are just out of school or young, and they have nothing to lose, and they get some cheap thing and they do something spontaneous.
Yeah.
Of course, like your son will never stop being right. that way, but mm-hmm. he's an example to us all.
Yeah.
But this,
in Brooklyn,
what happens
right.
is there's two things become what there gets to be stuff at stake here. One's reputation, making money, putting their family through, you know, a roof over their heads, and all of this gets into the commercial side of art. And as soon as the commercial side takes over, this type of spontaneity,
mm-hmm. yeah.
talking about spontaneous curating, goes usually out the window, and people start playing it safe and putting in a pattern that they know yeah. will provide sort of like a commercial
mm-hmm. yeah.
Success. And Iowa has almost nothing but commercial galleries. You usually only see it in, I mean, CSPS is a nonprofit alternative space, and our space is a nonprofit alternative space. And then when it gets into the level of the museum, then they usually get a little more constricted in their yeah, presentations. Right. That's why this is so sure. refreshing what's being done at that museum.
Well,
so you don't see this type, I mean, a really truly artistic community that really wants to make mm-hmm. it happen. It's where the business people and the city council and the chamber and all of that get together and mm-hmm. decide, we're going to create some art spaces
yeah.
that'll create creative energy.
Yeah.
For the artists go there, like in Brooklyn right now, apparently Brooklyn is now the place
right.
where, because they can rent cheap spaces, there's supposed to be some very exciting things like this happening in these big spaces that young artists are now using in Brooklyn. But who knows what the evolution of that is going to be. You
yeah.
know, that,
well, generally, it raises property values to the point where the artists can't afford to be there anymore, and mm-hmm. everyone else benefits, and the artists move on.
You move on and find another Brooklyn, right?
Yeah.
But maybe Fairfield.
Yeah. yeah.
But we have to get everyone on board thinking this way. Mm-hmm. If more people get on board to think that Fairfield can be the center of some kind of art world, yeah. the faster it'll happen. And mm-hmm. these kinds yeah. of great things can happen here.
Listening to Icon Art Radio, a production of Iowa Contemporary Art, Fairfield.